I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice. Welcome to the Writer's Voice on the Virginia Voice. Today I'm happy to welcome Nancy Wright Beasley, who is a Richmond writer. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
A Richmond writer who writes for, among other publications, Richmond Magazine. Now, you're a contributing editor and a columnist
there?
Yes,
I've had a column for 12 years now, and I also do long research pieces, usually a couple of times a year, features.
But Richmond's not the only publication you write for.
No, but it's primarily the publication that I work for. I do have others, but my heart's in Richmond.
And did you start with Richmond Magazine, or what has been your development as a writer?
No, I've been writing over 30 years. I began quite accidentally in 1979 when my husband bet me $10 that I would get a job with the Richmond News Leader if I just applied, and I needed a haircut. He didn't want me to cut my hair ever, so I took him up on the bet, lost the bet, had to go to work, and he wouldn't let me cut my hair for a year.
So you started at the News Leader?
I started as a state correspondent for the Richmond News Leader and was there until I resigned in 1986 and went into the corporate world of publications for a while.
Where in the corporate world did you work?
Well, I worked in a couple of different electric cooperatives, one in Mecklenburg County, one in Fredericksburg. My husband passed away in 1991, and because of his guidance, I had a job. I was a homemaker when he made that bet with me. And I also did some work in economic development and PR, so it was sort of a smorgasbord.
But the heart belongs in writing.
The heart belongs to writing. I always come back to it and always will.
Now, you said you've been with Richmond Magazine for a number of years, and I know that we have enjoyed your columns. We've read them here on the Virginia Voice. Wonder if you could read a column for us from your work.
I would like that very much. I have a column that I read when I do public appearances that strikes, I think, a chord with many people my age, and we'll say I'm over 60. But anyway, I grew up on a farm, and that is one of my most treasured memories. And this column was published in June of 1998. I started as a columnist in April of 98, so this was one of my very first ones. And it's called Blue Mornings, What I Learned from a Rooster and a Galvanized Bucket. People who live in the city miss a lot, especially blue mornings, and the lessons that farm animals can teach. There's nothing quite like getting out of bed and standing on the porch before the sun comes up. While the rooster is doing his best to alert the world that a new day has dawned, the cows mill around at the barn making a wailing, mournful sound, calling out to the hands that will feed them and relieve the pressure of their milk. Sometimes the sky is a muddled purplish blue with streaks of white. Pretty soon, pale pink shows up, followed by a little orange, and suddenly the sun burst open on a new day. I used to stand barefoot on the front porch looking at the dawn just before going out to milk my cow, Buttercup. Recalling those times brings back memories of growing up on a farm in Christiansburg, Virginia. That's where I learned to love the feel of mud between my toes and to enjoy the sheer abandon of jumping from a high tree while hanging on to a grapevine. I can still feel the rush in the pit of my stomach that comes while daring to leap from the tree limb without falling. I've envied birds their ability to fly ever since catapulting through the woods in late afternoons. My brother and two sisters and I all had responsibilities. I can't remember much about theirs, but I sure recall mine. Because I was the baby girl, as my daddy called me, I got off rather light when it came to chores. Besides milking my cow, my other job was to rob the hens. Mama always gave me a galvanized bucket to gather the eggs in. She never failed to caution me about being careful not to drop it. The bucket was almost as big as I was. It took both my hands to hold it above ground when it was filled with eggs. Each day I'd pick up the bucket, being careful not to squeak the handle. I'd sneak up on the chicken pen and stand just outside the fence waiting for that blamed white rooster to go around to the back of the hen house. If he saw me, he chased me all the way to the hen house. Of course, when I merged with the eggs, he'd be standing at the door waiting to chase me again. Day after day, the quest went on. I tried to get to the hen house. He tried to catch me. I don't know why he didn't follow me into the hen house, but he never did. He probably instinctively knew there was only one way out, and I knew he was there just waiting for me. At the time, I was sure he was as big as I was. When that rooster fluffed his feathers, he looked 5 feet tall. I think he took delight in tormenting me. I was probably the only human he'd ever seen who was short enough for him to conquer. Every day when I'd pick up the bucket and head out to gather the eggs, my heart would start thumping so hard I could taste the sound. One day I made it to the hen house without him seeing me, found the eggs and was on the way out when that rooster came upon me by surprise. He laid back and tried to flog me. His spurs were several inches long and sharp enough to rip holes in my legs. I was convinced that I was going to die. He ran circles around me while I stood frozen in one spot. I was too far from the house for anyone to hear my squalls of terror. I kept the bucket between me and the rooster. He was getting madder and madder because he couldn't reach me. It was a do-or-die situation. When the rooster backed up to catch his breath, I wound up that bucket like a slingshot and took aim. I probably had visions of David and Goliath at the time, or I wouldn't have had the nerve to try to overcome him. With all my might, I slung that bucket, and it found its mark. I recovered the bucket, and spilling eggs as I went, ran wildly through the gate. Shutting the gate, I turned to see the rooster wobbling toward the hen house. I was halfway hoping he'd die, and knowing I'd be in trouble if he did. I have told no one of my experience until this day. The rooster lived, but he learned a lot of respect for that bucket. After that, he hightailed it to the other side of the pen when I even got close to the gate. Some days I'd squeak the handle just to watch him run. Like many other experiences on the farm, that lesson taught me a lot about life. I learned that I could experience my worst fears and still survive, and it taught me how to dig in my heels and stand my ground when the winds of life blew hard enough to almost tear my clothes off. I seldom see a blue morning or hear a rooster crow, but I don't wonder if there's some child trying to conquer a daily chore and inadvertently learning how to face the world.
What a wonderful column. What a wonderful column. And I noticed that you were reading that column out of a book, Reflections of a Purple Zebra. This is a book of your columns?
Yes, it's a book of 60 columns. I've written more than that, but those were chosen for a book.
And all of those 60 were published in the Richmond Magazine?
They were originally published in Richmond Magazine.
Wow. So, well, now, this is not the only book
No.
that you have written. And what we want to talk about next is a book that I think has garnered a lot of attention for you. And from everything that I read and from just talking with you, my sense is that this book has also made a very big difference in your life.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm talking, of course, about Izzy's Fire. Tell our listeners a little bit about this book and how it came to be.
Well, I moved to Fredericksburg after my husband's death in 1991, and I did some freelance work up there for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star. Then I moved to Richmond because my mother was diagnosed with cancer, and I came to help her. And I started freelancing in earnest at that time. And I got a call from Gwen Wolf, one of the editors at the Fredericksburg Freelance Star. And I'd written for her in the past, and she said, I want you to do a column on the Virginia Holocaust Museum. And I said, you don't have enough money. I will never write about the Holocaust. I find it so terrible. And I said, Gwen, if I wrote about the Holocaust, that would break my heart. It would just break my heart. And she said, that's why you're the one to do it. But I refused for months. And finally, out of respect for her, I went to a service at the Emek Shalom Holocaust Memorial Cemetery here in Richmond. They hold a service every November to commemorate Kristallnacht, 2 days in Austrian Germany, which is considered one of the first pogroms against the Jews, where about 30,000 Jews were arrested, synagogues were burned. It was an awful time. And at this service, I heard survivors saying the names of their family members who did not come home or did not survive the Holocaust, many who they don't even know where their bodies are. And I was pretty much okay until Alan Zim walked to the microphone, and Alan started saying the names of his family members and giving them identities. And when he began to say these names, I counted them off on my fingers, and I ran out of fingers, and he kept saying names, and all I could hear was my brother, my brother, my brother, and it was just overwhelming. And I said, okay, I'm in, because at that moment, I saw the Holocaust not as an event, but as a family. He was able, just by saying, you know, his family's names, to bring that horrific event down to one house. And so after that service was over, I went up to him and I said, "You have changed my life." And I knew that my work would be reflected in that. And I couldn't write about Alan's story because it was so horrific. Only he and his brother survived out of a huge family. And at the time, his brother had just died, I believe. So he was a sole survivor. But Alan Zim was just my hero. So I went to the museum and I wrote about the museum. And I met Edna Ibsen, who became part of my heartbeat. And when I learned of the story of this courageous farm family in Lithuania who helped them survive, them and several other Jews, there were actually 13 Jews representing five families, it was such a courageous story that I felt like it needed to be told. And that's, I guess, a long answer to a short question.
A wonderful answer. Nancy, why do you think you are so affected by this event? Or I feel funny saying the word event now that you have said that for you the Holocaust has now become a family. But
The Holocaust was minimized. I think that was it. And not only that, but I'm a Christian, and I thought, what must it be like if I happen to be sitting in church services one day and people rushed in with machine guns and killed me because I was a Christian? And the unfairness of it, I had read Anne Frank, of course. I had done some background work, but I always ran from it because it was so horrific. And I think it was because it was so huge. And Alan Zim, here was this, he's a small man, was standing there, and he was so brave, you know, saying all of these names. His history was wiped out, and yet he was still standing.
Now, you wrote your articles about the Holocaust Museum, but
that's where it began.
That was only a beginning.
Yes,
tell me
it was.
What happened next, and how did the book then come about?
Well, I met Edna Ibsen, and as I said, she just became part of my heartbeat. It was interesting that the first time I met her, we cried together, which was the beginning of many times. But she had just been widowed 6 months earlier. I had been a widow for 6 years, so we had that instant bond, and I remember her saying to me, "Oh, I'm sorry about crying," and I said, "No, no, no, there's more room out than in. You can't look that way. You have to let it out." And I think the fact that we embraced each other and we had that common loss is what started it. And as I talked with her and grew to love her, I just felt like it was an amazing story that she lived basically because of her uncle being a farmer. He did not go into Kovno Ghetto, and he made a way for them to escape Kovno Ghetto and had a place for them to stay. And it's a farm story. I'm a farm girl. This is a farm story.
Interesting that you chose a farm story column to read for us. So you had a number of things that made you identify really with Edna.
And I felt compelled to write it. I didn't want to write it. I I hated it. I hated the thought of going into the Holocaust in depth because I'm an immersion writer. The pieces that I do are very long pieces usually, and sometimes it takes me a year to research a project. So in that amount of time, I literally begin to absorb a lot of things. And that was not an easy walk. And having lost my husband, I lost both of my parents while I was writing the book. I felt compelled to do it. I was my parents' caregiver, main caregiver, and I was also working as a freelance writer and a columnist. I was pursuing a master's degree at VCU. And trying to survive as a freelance writer. And only a crazy person would take on a project like this, or someone compelled. I was compelled to do this.
How long did it take you to write the book?
7 years.
And how about the search for a publisher? How did that go?
Well, I started out applying to publishers, or to agents, rather, and the tragedy that I did not know was that I should have done it much in advance. And because I was a novice, I'd never written a book, I thought it had to be finished first. And so by the time I got around to shopping it, it was very late in the process, and Mrs. Ibsen was getting older and quite ill, and I really wanted it to get out, so I self-published. And it's just been amazing. The reaction to it has been amazing. And beautifully, Mrs. Ibsen is still alive. It's been 5 years. My mother did not live to see it, but I have a feeling she does see it.
Did much of the preparation involve sitting and talking to Mrs. Ibsen?
Oh, yes. Yes. Lots and lots of time was spent that way.
Did you ever take pieces that you had written over to her to read them to her?
Absolutely. She was my guiding light. I had Izzy's memoirs, which had been written, and of course he had died, so where there might be something I didn't understand, she filled it in. And I was also taking Judaism classes at the time, at night, to understand my subjects better. So I didn't have a lot of time, but when I would go to her house, she always fed me. Always I had to eat. It's a wonder I didn't gain 300 pounds. But often she would not want to talk about the book. And then we would go for like a month or more, and she wouldn't talk about it. And so I finally learned that by reading chapters of it to her, it would ease her into the subject, because it was very, very painful. And we always cried every time I went to see her. I mean, that was a given. We would sort of get it over with and then go on. And during the process, you know, we cried.
At the risk of making you and me and our listeners cry, could you read some of the book to
us?
Yes,
let me say something first, if you would. I had an angel besides my mother, and it was Neil November. Neil November was behind me every step of the way, and he introduced me to Carol Weinstein, and Carol and Neil helped me get the book out on the initial publication. So I would be remiss not to mention that, because Neil especially has been with me every step of the way, and he's still with me, and for that I'm so grateful. And I will read. I used to read from when they were forced into the ghetto, but I found that that was very difficult. So I will read a little background. The book is written through Edna's voice. Her name at the time was Etta, and when they came to America, she changed it to Edna. But the book is written as if you are standing behind Edna watching the scenes unfold. So what I read is her actual, she's telling the story. And they had escaped from Kovno Ghetto because of her uncle. He found a place for them to go. And they were living underground in a 9x12x4 hole and had been joined by the uncle. At that time, there were 13 underground, 9 adults and 4 little boys.
I want to stop you there, because I've been thinking about a 9x12x4 hole. Does that mean that they had to lay down?
They had to lie down the entire time. They could only crawl on their hands and knees. And that's right. They had to lie down, and there was barely enough space. If you can imagine, there were five families represented there, and there was a lot of tension. And so not only did they not necessarily mingle with each other, there had to be space between them. So it was, you know, I've always said I can't get along with my relatives above the ground. So I can't imagine what it would be like to get that close with people that you're not always intimate with, you know, and you're forced into it. It's life or death. You're starving. Lots of things. But this comes from chapter 13, which I've always considered my lucky number. So I like this. I did just worked out that way.
And this is a later point in the story after they're back above ground.
This is when they begin their liberation.
Okay.
And so at this point, they had been underground for over 2 months. And so this was quite a day. Early one morning, Izzy suddenly sat bolt upright and said, "Etta, do you feel that? The earth is shaking. Maybe it's a tank." Izzy's words jolted everyone out of their sleep. We held our breath and huddled together as Izzy cautiously crawled through one of the tunnels to the opening of the potato hole. My heart was beating so hard I was sure everyone could hear it. I grabbed Jay, pulled him close, and wrapped my sweater around him. In just a few seconds, Izzy shouted back to us, "I can see a tank! I can see the Russians!" We sat in stunned silence for several minutes, trying to take in the meaning of Izzy's words. We were afraid to believe what he was saying. It was too much, too quickly. We all sat frozen in place until Izzy came halfway back into the hiding place and started calling impatiently, "Hurry! Come out, come out! It's safe now!" Izzy ran up the ladder again and turned to offer his hands to Jay, who was scrambling close behind him. About the time I got to the top of the potato hole, Mr. Paskauskas ran out of his house, waving his arms. He was yelling, "You're free! You're free! The Russians are here! The Russians are here!" As Mr. Paskauskas helped the others crawl out of the pit, Izzy and I watched in amazement while several Russian tanks came into view in the distance. The fields were ripe with Russian soldiers, all carrying guns and running as if they were on fire. Standing there, I felt like I was part of a dream. From the ghetto until now, we had been waiting almost 3 years for this moment. We just couldn't take it in. It was happening at a whirlwind pace. Finally realizing it was true, Izzy and I grabbed Jay's hands and began to dance around in circles. Our legs were so stiff from lying down that we could hardly stand up straight, but we danced anyway. I ran back to the potato hole to wait for Uncle Itzhak and Ida to come above ground, hugging and kissing them when they stepped into the open. We were overcome with emotion, and all of us began crying with joy, even the men. It was overwhelming to understand that we had survived.
Lovely.
Thank you.
The book has been very well received.
Yes. It was amazing to me. It was chosen as a People's Choice nominee. There were 65 nonfiction books nominated to the Library of Virginia for awards, and of that, 5 were chosen as People's Choice books, and Izzy was one of those. I did not win the final award, but to be nominated was amazing.
It is quite an honor to be nominated and to be chosen as one of the 5. Did you tell me that the book has also been used in schools?
It's been used in many schools. In Chesterfield County, it has been taught since its inception. In fact, that was one of the reasons it was self-published, because they ordered 90 copies and I had not finished the book. So they wanted it by January 2005 and I had no option but to finish it. And I am pleased to say that's where I graduated from high school, Manchester High School, and Manchester Middle has been using that book since then, as well as other schools. And there are some universities who've used it. I've spoken to the University of Richmond here, and that's been part of the curriculum there, and it's very exciting.
Now you're working on a new project.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I can. Again, I need to thank Neil November, because he made it possible for me to get a graduate degree at Hollins University in Roanoke. I'm almost there. What I have left is to write a thesis, and that is going to be a young adult historical novel, and I'm supposed to have it written before next January.
Well, good luck to you
on that. Thank you.
Do you think I could persuade you to read one more tiny bit from Izzy's Izzy? Five? I know I'm springing this.
Yes, you are, and I'm not sure what part to read. I think another highlight in my life was to meet Stanislavas Kravikius, who was a teenager. He was the stepson of Vaclavas Paskauskas, and he was the son of Ona Paskauskas. And you heard me say, Mr. Paskauskas said, come out, come out. The Russians are here. That family was a friend of Itzhak Kolomitsky, who was Edna's uncle. And it gets a little convoluted with all the characters. But interestingly enough, when the Virginia Holocaust Museum was getting ready to celebrate their first year anniversary, a letter came from Lithuania from Stanislavas. It was addressed incorrectly, went to a different address, and somehow made its way. It's too long to go into, but it was miraculously made its way back to the Virginia Holocaust Museum, and it was translated by a woman who, I was amazed, lived only blocks from me. So it's strange how the book has sort of surrounded me. And as a result of that, Stanislavas came to America, and I got to meet him and interview him about the time when he was a teenager, when these people were coming to live, and they just opened their hearts. I think I should read maybe Edna's apprehension about, she called him Stasuk, which is a nickname, about him coming to America. And I was there when she saw him, and I was there when he left. And it was amazing that her son, Jay, helped orchestrate his arrival here in America. And to stand on that tarmac when those families reunited after all those years was quite amazing. This chapter is titled Edna's Apprehension, and I'll just read a little bit of it. When Ellie showed Jay the letter, Ellie is Jay Ibsen's wife, and she's the one who had the letter, got the letter from the post office. When Ellie showed Jay the letter, he confirmed the name on the return address was indeed that of Stasuk, the teenage boy who had helped them. Jay and Ellie were so excited that they brought me the letter the same night, thinking I could interpret it. At first, I thought I recognized a few letters, but then I finally gave up. Jay, I'm so sorry. Nothing seems to make sense. Who could believe I would forget my own language? But I have. I don't even know anyone who speaks Lithuanian. Do you? Obviously disappointed, Jay shrugged his shoulders and turned to Ellie. And I'm skipping a little bit here. Then they found Rita Gatak through the Boys and Girls Club of Richmond, and Rita translated the book, translated the letter, and I will read the letter. I think that would be the most fitting here. He found a stack of letters that his parents, who were deceased, had. He found it going through, evidently, their home, and it had the address on Carey Street. And the Ibsens had stayed in touch with them until the Iron Curtain fell and they lost contact. It had been over 30 years since they'd heard from them when this letter came. This is the letter. I'm writing you a letter, honored friends. I'm greeting you and wish you health and much luck. Perhaps you won't remember me. When you were with us, my parents hid you from the Germans, who had at that time seized Lithuania and were killing your nation. There were 16 people of your nation. If you ever come to Lithuania, please come to visit me. We lived together like brothers and sisters, and had the Germans ever found out, all of us would have been shot to death. If you come to visit me, I will show you those places where we lived together. And I stop writing now and say goodbye. And then he lists his address and his name, Stanislavas Kravikius. The only thing he had wrong there was there were 13, not 16. But to have that kind of memory, you know that he participated in helping them live. And I think that was the amazing part. When he was here, I interviewed him. And I said, can you tell me if your parents ever discussed this? He said, oh, yes, we talked about it. And I said, well, people were killing Jews everywhere. Why did your parents want to do this? And he said, they were human beings. And he also told a story of how his father, who was a farmer, had gone to Kaunas to try and sell some vegetables, and he saw the Nazis marching the Jewish children out of the ghetto, knowing they were going to be killed. And he was helpless. He was one man with a wagon. And Stasuk told me, he cried when he told the story again of his father. So when Itzhak Kolomitsky approached them to help care for his family, they opened their hearts, and they were desperately poor. They had a dirt floor. They were desperately poor. How they helped keep them alive is beyond me. Beyond me.
We've been talking with Nancy Wright Beasley, who is a contributing editor at Richmond Magazine. She also writes a column there each month. Her collection of columns is called Reflections of a Purple Zebra. And the book that she has also been reading for us is Izzy's Fire, Finding Humanity in the Holocaust. Thanks for listening. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.